Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another fun-filled hour with the FIA Group. This topic is the first 100 days President-elect Donald J. Trump, healthcare, and self-funding. I'm a little sad today. Ron Peck decided to go on vacation this week. So, you know, he picked the wrong week because this is the highest attended webinar we've ever had. So I want everyone to please email him and let him know the fact is that without Ron on the webinar, we had the highest attended webinar in FIA's history when he wasn't there. So unlike Jen, when we have Jen, it seems to be like just a huge crowd. And so, of course, Jen is on this one as well. But with me, not as always, but now who will continue to be with me, is our Vice President of Consulting, Jen McCormick. Say hello, Jen.
Good afternoon.
And this is a special day for our attorney, Brady Bizarro. He is one of our attorneys in our consulting department. He is the FIA Group's political expert. He's the guy that would be on Fox News or CNN, maybe not MSNBC, I'm not really sure.
No, not yet.
But this is our political expert. He's the guy. He is the one that literally made sure to email the staff telling them they have the right to leave the office to go vote on election day. That is Brady. I'm like, Brady, you realize that we're losing productivity, but Brady feels it's our national civic duty to go and vote no matter what the reason, just to vote. So Brady is joining us, and he's going to have a huge role in this presentation because, as I said before, he is our political junkie here in our webinar. So say hello, Brady.
Good afternoon, guys.
So as I mentioned, this is probably, from an attendance standpoint, it's double the average we get. So even though it's a short week, obviously this topic has a lot of interest to all of you. So we're going to get right into it right away. And to tell you why, how this happened. So the day after the election, last Wednesday, right? No, two Wednesdays ago, we received over 100 emails within the first day, within the first 24 hours of Trump being elected president. We received over 100 emails directed to PGC referral asking us how this will impact. So we did not need to do a top 10 inquiry. We pretty much knew that a lot of people wanted to know what's going to happen, and we basically used PGC referral at FIA Group to identify what those issues are. So we're going to talk today about what hundreds of you have been asking us about in the past couple weeks is basically how this is going to affect our country, but more probably importantly for you is how this is going to affect your operation and your interaction with your clients and to help you deal with the questions that most certainly your clients have. As always, you know, you may know, may not know, our ICE service is available for independent consultation evaluation where you pay a flat monthly fee and you have access to Jen, Brady, our entire team of legal experts in our compliance department without having monthly invoicing or billing done. So with that, let's go to the next slide. Already Brady's
a little excited there.
Brady, you just got to slow down and relax. It's okay. It's only a couple thousand people that are listening. You'll be all right. Don't worry about it. So as always, please, after you attend our webinar, which you are doing now, please visit our LinkedIn or Twitter page and post some honest feedback about our webinar. And if you get chosen, you'll win 1 hour of free consultative guidance from our team of legal scholars. Please feel free to check in on our LinkedIn page and our Twitter feed. Again, Brady, too fast. It's okay. Leave it there. Feel free to check in on our LinkedIn page and Twitter page for some really cool insight as to what's happening in the industry today. So let's go into it. So obviously these are two choices that most people went with. It was either Trump or Ms. Clinton. And with that, Brady, you're on the stage. This is only a job on the line, so let's hope for the best. Brady, take over.
Well, thanks, Adam. And as many of you can see, I'm pretty excited to get into the results here. And we need to just go over a quick recap of how did Trump do this. So one of the first things you'll notice here on this graph is that the number of battleground states, and Trump needed to do well in all of them, and he did. He did well in Florida, in Ohio. He won Iowa like he needed to. But the reason he really won this election is because he cracked a hole in what was known as the blue firewall, which was for Hillary Clinton, it was in the Rust Belt. She needed to win Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. And what I noticed early on in the night is that it was taking a long time for her to win states she should have won quickly, like Virginia. And so that was the first indicator that she may have been in some trouble. And obviously at the end of the day, she was in trouble when she lost North Carolina. The same types of voters tend to vote in Wisconsin and Michigan in the same way as North Carolina. And so the reason you'll see on your map here that Michigan is not officially colored in is because the results are still being counted. Trump has won, and he's going to keep his lead there, but it's not certified. So the projected totals in the Electoral College, you see that Trump 306 projected and Clinton has 232. And so the other part of this election is that it was an issue-based election, and polling shows that 74% of people listed repealing Obamacare as a top issue, and that was, of course, one of Trump's main parts of his campaign. So we move on now to the more controversial result, which is the popular vote result. And as you can see from the graphic I have up here, I checked this result just last night at 11 p.m. to see where the numbers were at, and it's pretty amazing. Hillary Clinton has a 1.7 million vote lead in the national popular vote. Now, that's a pretty big deal. This is the fifth time overall this has happened where a candidate has won the popular vote and lost the election, second time since 2000. And in 2000, when Al Gore lost the election, he won the popular vote by 500,000 votes. So she's doing much better than that, and she's dominating the vote in states like California and New York, as you'd expect, Democratic strongholds. And the votes are still being counted. You had people that mailed in their votes in California, millions of people, and it's taking a long time, obviously, to count those votes.
Hey, Brady, do you expect this number to hit 2 million?
I think it will, and that'll be a big deal, because 2 million votes, that's 2 million more people who voted for her than for him, and that would obviously affect. The big number, though, to watch is will her total reach 50%? It's unlikely, but possible based on how the numbers keep coming in. But, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the media about, well, we should abolish the Electoral College. We can't have someone winning more votes and losing the election. Well, it happens. This is the system we've got, you know.
Now, real quick, just some housekeeping. Feel free to text us or those questions there as well. We're getting a bunch of people are asking if this webinar is recorded. We apologize. We assume that this is not everyone's first time. Yes, the webinar is recorded. The slides will be available on our website, fiatgroup.com, after this is over. And we're also getting a bunch of questions, people asking us about the legalized marijuana here in the state of Massachusetts. Yes, you can now come into FIA with the joint and smoke as much as you want, and you will not be arrested for it. So if there's anything, if we say anything stupid, that might be the reason behind it. But you're right, as of January 1st, it's recreational marijuana that has been legalized here in Massachusetts, just like in the great state of Colorado. So, all right, let's keep going.
All right, so next we need to look at, arguably as an emergency, the results in the House and the Senate. And so this is the, the first time since 2005 that Republicans have controlled both the House and the Senate and the presidency. And so you'll see here that we have one race still outstanding. It's going to come down to a runoff election in Louisiana. But Republicans are going to have 52 seats in the Senate, and the Democrats have 48. And so that's important for a number of reasons, mostly because it'll help Trump to push his agenda. And so with 52 senators, the things he can pass in the Senate that just require a simple majority, he'll be able to do.
So quick question, Brady. Sorry to put you on the spot here.
All right.
My responsibility. Ron's been texting me to make sure I do that to you. In Obama's first 100 days, what was the House of Representatives and Senate set up? How was that set up at that time?
So at that point, Nancy Pelosi was the Speaker, so the Democrats had control of the House, and I believe they had control of the Senate as well.
They had the same exact control as Trump will have.
And you'll remember that didn't last very long because the Tea Party movement swept in and the Republicans took control.
But in the first 100 days,
the first time
both parties, in both scenarios, they all had complete control.
So I could be wrong on that. Yep. Someone out there might have the stats and might prove me wrong, but I'm pretty sure that there was a brief time where he had control of both, which is why he got a lot of things done, and we'll get to that in a later slide about the first 100 days. But for Trump, it's a big deal because he's essentially got a mandate legislatively.
2 years.
And so, and recently this past weekend, you saw perhaps there were some elections in the Senate. The new majority leader for the the minority leader will be Harry Reid from New York. And Trump actually likes, it will be Chuck Schumer from New York. And Trump likes him. They have a relationship from New York, so you can bet that there'll be some dealing going on between those two in the future.
Yeah, we're already getting some comments. Thank you, audience, for dialing in. Tell us that the Democrats did have complete control for the first particular 2 years. And a couple people also bringing up the popular vote. We are very well aware that Trump did not spend as much money, and a lot of people saying that if he had more money, he would have tried to win the popular vote, but that was not obviously the objective. We get that. We're just sharing the information that's out there from the popular vote as well as the Electoral College. We're obviously aware of, from a civics lessons in our schools, that what matters is the Electoral College, but we just point out the information that's obviously available out there.
Right, a quick bookend to that is that Trump himself has said that he would have campaigned differently. You know, if the objective was to win the most votes, you'd focus in the five most populous states. So
right.
It would have been a different race. We totally
but keep those questions coming. So, Brady, you share with us on the first 100 days, you know, why it's significantly important. Let's get right into it.
Sure. So the first 100 days is a benchmark that was really put into place under FDR in the midst of the Great Recession, the Great Depression in that case. He instituted the New Deal. And so he pushed through a lot of legislative initiatives quickly. And so ever since then, the first 100 days has been seen as an opportunity for a president to portray his message, to get things done quickly, to set the agenda for the next, say, 1,000 days.
Is that basically the best time because it's a new president?
It is,
they have the most political clout to get things done. Is that why?
Absolutely, it is. And in the case, obviously, of having both houses of Congress and arguably a Supreme Court that'll help, it's the time where you're most likely to get things done. And so if you look back at President Obama's first 100 days, this is back now since January 2009, he did a lot of things. The first day, you may remember, he issued some executive orders to deal with things to do with interrogation of detainees, but he also had to push through the economic stimulus package, which was a big deal. It was $787 billion, and that was right in the middle of the meltdown, and that got through, which was a big deal for him. He also outlined his vision for healthcare, which was a more long-term plan, but as part of Obamacare, he passed the SCHIP program, which expanded health care for children, which is important on his list. He also reversed the ban on stem cell research, and it's unclear how Trump is going to act with that. But these are things that he accomplished since, I guess, the end of April of 2009. He passed the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which was an equal pay act for women. He obviously got a budget approved, which this time around seems a little less clear because what the Congress is doing now is they're passing a continuing resolution, which will delay, essentially, budget talks. So that could make Trump's ride a little more bumpy. He had, as I said, he had some longer-term goals of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He wanted to restore relations with Cuba. He's done those things. And, of course, he did pass the ACA. So what are some things that he didn't accomplish? Well, as people have pointed out over and over again, he didn't get actually Guantanamo Bay closed. He said he would do that. Hasn't done that. The big one, though, and if you ask people in the administration, they've told reporters that he didn't get a comprehensive immigration reform done. And, you know, I think you'll hear is that presidents generally have a limited amount of political capital they can use. And Obama expended a lot of that getting the Affordable Care Act passed. He wasn't able in his second term to pass immigration reform like he would have wanted to.
So even though we're getting a lot of we've never received this many comments from people, it seems. But even though a lot of people, it's like a live interview, a lot of people are saying that Obama didn't get IT done. In the first 100 days, it looks like he actually got some stuff done. Whether or not they turned out great is a different argument, but a lot of stuff was passed within the first 100 days, Brady. Is that what you're saying?
Right, it was. I mean, and it's tough to get – I mean, remember, Congress is designed to move slowly. So just because the president wants to get things done quickly doesn't mean it'll actually happen. So, yes, one of the comments here says that he had a bigger majority in the Senate. That's true. And so he in theory, could have gotten things done more easily than even Trump can. Okay, so let's move on to look at what are we
doing. So go back to that last one.
Sure.
So what we have here is this is, you know, how it turned out. We see about six things done. Obviously, the long-term goal, you know, the ACA, which, you know, isn't still a goal. It's not affordable, right? We all know that. However, there were six things that were completed within that first 100 days, right?
Right, yeah.
All right, so let's look now at Trump's – this is his exhaustive list of 10 things that he's looking at, 10-point legislative plan.
Right.
Start with the top.
And so Trump gave these out in a speech he made in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, where he listed 10 legislative action points, the Middle Class Tax Relief and Simplification Act. He wants to end the Offshoring Act, which would help people, the oil producers and such. The American Energy and Infrastructure Act is a big opportunity to work with Democrats to pass bills that will help us rebuild the infrastructure in this country.
So we're talking railroads, highways, bridges.
And Trump's a builder, he said. So we'll see if he's able to get a deal done with the Democrats to make these shovel-ready jobs, the term we've heard before. That'll be coming back. The School Choice and Education Opportunity Act. This is about bringing education local. You heard him on the campaign show talking about Common Core. That'll be a tough sell.
So in Massachusetts, for those of you who aren't from here, and based on the comments we're getting, I'm assuming most of you aren't from here because in Massachusetts, I think Hillary won by what percentage of the vote?
It was a big, at least maybe 20%. It was a lot.
Right. She killed them, right? So a lot of people, you know, here in Massachusetts, we passed a law that you can smoke weed anywhere, grow, I think, 6 plants in your home.
Enough.
Right. Enough that you could have it for like a year, right? Or through a major blizzard at least. No. And then, but we have that. We make sure that farm animals aren't in cages.
Right.
But we... we don't have charter schools. We are not allowing an expansion of charter schools to help our young kids. Very interesting.
You'll see now the fifth one on this list is actually put there on purpose, and that's repeal and replace the Obamacare Act. And as you know, obviously this is what most of the focus of the next few slides will be about. The remaining things he has here, I mean, this is an ambitious list, right? We see child care, immigration. We'll see if he gets to those.
But the key thing we want to focus on, obviously, is this repeal and replace Obamacare Act,
right,
which is what we're going to talk about now.
All right, so we see here, what do people like about the ACA? This is a list that was compiled by the Kaiser Foundation three years ago. And it lists here two graphs that are important. One is, who knows about these components of the ACA? And the other is, what do people actually like about it?
So the orange is what people like. Whether or not they actually are aware that it exists is in blue.
Right.
So if you're telling me on the first one, the tax credit to small businesses to buy insurance, only half the people know about it, but 88% of the people like it.
Right, yeah, they just figured that out. And yet, look at the individual mandate at the bottom there. 74% didn't know, or I'm sorry, they were aware of it, but it's only 40% popular. And so that's an issue we're going to see going forward, is that that mandate is not very popular. But the other parts of the law, you know, the donut hole and Medicare, the obviously the dependent coverage for children, the subsidy assistance, those are all popular parts of the law. And they're things that Trump has said very recently that he wants to be able to keep. We break this down further here on the next slide, where we have a list of essentially what people like about the ACA. We just talked about two of them, which is extending dependent coverage up to age 26.
So on that first one, the age 26, right?
Right.
You know, what we do know is that from an insurance carrier standpoint, this doesn't really cost them that much money to keep this around, because the assumption is most people up until age 26 either are healthy or don't go to the doctor at all, or both.
Right.
So that's why, you know, we could see something like this being something that, you know, most carriers really don't care about getting rid of.
There's not much of an impact as far as costs are concerned.
The second one, Brady, is one that is obviously, you know, from an emotional standpoint, I just don't see how someone could ever take this away. But,
yeah. I mean, in general, right. It's once you give the goodies out, as they say, it's hard to take them back. And in this case, though, it's a big deal, because the guaranteed issue, I mean, this really only works with the mandate, if you think about it, because the idea is we don't want people to wait until they're sick to get coverage. But this guaranteed issue means that insurance companies are forced to treat people the same, whether or not they have cancer or other conditions, they've got to treat them the same. And that's obviously very popular, and that's something that Trump has talked about. The tax credits for businesses, that's very popular. The subsidies are popular, obviously, unsurprisingly. The essential coverage requirements popular. The limits on deductibles, the annual lifetime.
Now, the minimum essential coverage requirements. Jen, can you just, for those people who don't know, what is the minimum incorporate?
So there are two prongs to the employer mandate. One is to offer coverage, and one is to have coverage that is both affordable and meets minimum value. There are a lot of different terms that people are talking about when they throw on the term MEC coverage. In general, when people talk about MEC coverage, they're referring to preventive care only. And preventive care only are the list of the services on the various task force for women, for children, and for men that are the preventive services that people need and should receive every day that are covered at 100%. That is essentially what people are talking about when they're talking about MEC coverage.
What doesn't it cover? Like, what's a big thing that wouldn't be covered under
inpatient hospital? A MEC plan does not typically cover inpatient hospitalization. It doesn't typically cover a lot of drugs. In fact, it doesn't cover a lot of the expensive costs of medical care or health care.
The oil change is covered, but if you actually needed a transplant or to change the transmission in the car, that's not covered.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, got it.
So the last remaining few here.
So the free preventative services ties right into the MEC coverage.
Right.
Exactly. And could be a good savings overall in the long run for people. The last few things here are, again, controversial if Trump touches them, but the Medicaid expansion, which many states have declined to do, but some have expanded Medicaid, if he makes changes to that, we'll see, you know, that could affect, obviously, the number of people that are covered in total. Same with the SCHIP program. It covers roughly 9 million children. I don't see Trump really messing with that program much. It's a state-run program, so maybe his idea, like he has with Medicaid, which is that he would block grants to the states and let them run these programs.
The key thing I think on this list is what people like that is a little scary for us, from the fact that we get data on the claims, is there's no annual or lifetime dollar limit. There's no question that it seems, and based on the data, what we thought is true is true. The average claim cost is going up. I mean, we're just seeing a lot, many more million-dollar claims than we had in the past. And I know this is an issue that we repeatedly hear about.
The thing that's interesting, too, about that is that, yes, the cost of claims are going up, but not the utilization of those claims.
Right, so if we move on now to the opposite, right? What do people dislike about the ACA. And there are, again, some pretty big ones on this list, first and foremost of which is the individual and employer mandate. Surprise, right? People don't like government regulations in general. Well, without, again, as I mentioned before, without the mandate, though, you know, you're going to have some trouble covering sick people, and these are problems that the exchanges have run into. Another thing here is that the increase in the Medicare payroll tax, again, you're asking people to pay more taxes, no one's going to like that. But the big one here, the biggest one, is the higher premiums and the fewer choices of insurers. This is a point that Trump hammered home in the last few weeks of the election. Perhaps unlucky for Hillary Clinton, the data came out which showed the increased numbers in certain states.
That came out when?
A few weeks before the election. I mean, it was enough time where Trump could hammer it home, but it was really not good news to the Democrats. And what I've done here is picked some of the examples of the most drastic increases in states. So, for example, Arizona, we see 145% increase. So your premium.
And how long of a period of time are we talking about that for Arizona?
So, I mean, this is projected for next year. This is what's going to go up next year. So your plan will go up from $207 a month
in 1 year.
In 1 year, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, that's, again, because people have been pricing in the cost of these sick risk pools, and the insurers are saying, hey, we've got to raise our rates. Look at Alabama, 71%, 67% in Indiana. I mean, and these numbers are, in a way, as disturbing, which is that 57% of exchange enrollees have a choice of three or more insurers in 2017. That's down from 85%. So you have fewer choices.
So basically, what we're noticing is something we learned, you know, of the anti-communist regimes, right? Less competition means higher prices.
That's right.
And we're seeing that right there.
And the other point to note here is that 32% of counties in this country will have one exchange insurer in 2017. That's up from only 7%. That's a massive increase.
So a 500% increase,
right,
in the number of counties where there's only one option if you want to be on the ACA.
Sure, and we can expect the price of those plans to go up because obviously there's only one person, one insurance company offering you coverage.
Now, one of the key things, the next point, is, you know, what we have seen from employers. So one of the funny things that we, you know, whenever I hear the idea, and we're going to get right into that next, right, is the whole idea of the ACA, is talking about how much money, and this is amazing to me, right, is how much money has already been spent by employers. Because, again, whether you want to say that the carriers, we all know that they're just passing the buck down to the employee and the employers. How much money employers have spent, whether it's assembly benefits coverage, whether it's redlining their plan document, meeting their broker 20 times to go over all the different changes and options available to them, wondering if it's worth them paying a penalty or not. I mean, just how much time and effort has been spent getting all, not only the documents up to speed, how much time and money has been spent on just deciding what to do.
Right. That's right. It's not only money, it's resources. And resources are almost just as important as the money.
So the fact that people didn't like about the ACA is they have to do a lot more work,
right,
to become compliance, but first to even know if they even needed to become compliant or if they already were, or if they can stay as a grandfather plan, et cetera. So one of the funny things is when people talk about, oh, repeal and replace or repeal, think about it. We've spent, I don't even know, I'm assuming it's got to be billions, if not trillions, as an industry just dealing with ACA changes to now be told, oh, it's gone, forget everything you did. Then what? I'm assuming is that billions of dollars in changes again, to the non-ACA option, just something to think about. But there's no question that the dislike of the high-cost implementation has been a huge part of this. Brady?
And so now we'll move to, I know what many of you are waiting for, which is a discussion of what exactly is Trump's priorities here. They've sort of been wiffle-waffly, if you will, over time. He said a few things and taken some back. I mean, so he's been saying repeal and replace since the beginning, on day one. But he's then sort of softened his tone. Now he's saying, well, we might amend it. We may keep certain parts of it. And we mentioned some of this before, which is that the popular parts he wants to keep, so a dependent coverage extension to people up to 26, the ban on denying coverage for pre-existing conditions, that's also popular. That's very likely to stay in whatever Obamacare becomes. Maybe it should become Trump Care. We'll see if he puts his name on it. A few other ideas he had, though, and these kind of overlap with the Republican Congress ideas, which is to replace the ACA with tax-free HSAs. So he wants to push these health savings accounts. And unsurprisingly, the pushback from Democrats on this point has been, well, people, low-income people, aren't able to save money in their HSA account. And so I think you'll see Trump have to come up with something else to address that issue. But HSAs are popular.
Let's stop this. I want to get Jen's comment on this a little bit. So the first thing you mentioned was repeal and replace on day one. However, I'm assuming, unless we know what replace is, you can't repeal until you have a replace. Is that what you're seeing?
That's right, yeah. And he said he doesn't want any gap to come between the time that he repeals and replaces.
So obviously, it's not like they could just come up with a replace in a matter of a couple weeks. They have to come up with a plan.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right. So if they wanted that to happen simultaneously, to be no gap, we're not looking at anything that's going to happen day one here. Right?
I doubt it. I think on day one, all he'll really do is maybe cancel some of Obama's previous executive orders. But legislatively, that'll take some time.
Next is, obviously, we talked about the dependent coverage up to 26. These are the free goodies that people like. That one, obviously, doesn't really bother insurers that much. But the second one, the pre-existing condition, obviously, that would make carriers a lot money. They'd be happy with that one because they could deny bad risk on their plans. But this would cause... I mean, can you imagine?
Part of the operation of the taxes and the funding of having the ability to deny coverage or not deny coverage for pre-existing conditions is because of the mandate. That's how part of this is being funded. So if we are taking away the mandate but keeping the provision to allow coverage and not deny coverage based on someone's health factor, how is this going to be funded?
Right. There's no money for it. That's the point.
Right.
That's the key.
And more troubling there just quickly is that the end of next year, the cost-sharing subsidies that were being handed out to insurance companies with high-risk pools are going to end. So the problem is going to get worse.
Now, I want to get into this whole tax-free HSAs because this always bugged me. So employers right now and our clients, right, and administrators and the carriers already are having a hard time dealing with transparency, like people not knowing how much a surgery costs at hospital A versus hospital B.
Right.
So an employer with an HR department doesn't know the difference in costs, et cetera. So instead, the idea of the HSA is the employee is going to have some type of education and know where to spend their health care dollars more than anyone else.
And how are they going to get that?
Right. That's the part that I never got is, okay, having an HSA, I like that. I can see why it's good, it's tax-free, et cetera. But it doesn't actually lower the overall cost of care, right?
Right. It's a good vehicle, but it's not necessarily going to do anything to increase the transparency in and of itself.
Now, I love this, right? The next one is allowing plans to be sold across state lines. And we get a bunch of people, I'm not going to say their names, I don't know if they're joking or what, but they're asking about the advantages and disadvantages of being able to sell across state lines. Do either of you think that this will help in any way in regards to lowering overall costs? Because what you brought up in the slide prior was the fact that there's only one exchange option available for 30, I think you said, what was the number you mentioned, 32% of counties. So if you're able to buy insurance across state lines, would that mean that you can have access to exchanges in New York if you're in Arizona? Is that what you're talking about?
I mean, the thing that's interesting about the portability piece of Trump's plan, hazy, I mean, very clear plan, is that if we have the ability or carriers have the ability to sell across state lines, the objective is that it's going to increase competition. So there's going to be nationwide competition. But one of the things that Trump seems to not like is mandates. He doesn't like rules. He doesn't like all the regulation. So he wants to eliminate, Brady gave me the stat, for every two bills he wants to eliminate one, or for every one he wants to eliminate two.
Right, yep.
So the benefit of having, or the reason why there are lines in place from state to state about what benefits an insurer can offer is because there are different mandated benefits, there are different rules that are already in place that insurance carriers have to abide by. So not only would we have to do away with the ability to sell across state lines, that means that the benefits that would be offered in New York and California and Pennsylvania would all have to be similar, that people would be getting benefits that are very similar to a type of funding that we're very aware of, which is self-funding. It seems like this is going to be very analogous to how a self-funded ERISA plan would operate, in the sense that there would be the ability for someone in Massachusetts to buy a plan in California because they like the benefits that are offered in California.
Now, Brady, the next one is important, too. Make insurance premiums tax deductible.
Right. So for people who don't get their insurance through their employer, there would be, in theory, some sort of way they could purchase insurance and deduct that cost from their
So taxes. Right now, the only way it's deductible is if you purchase it from your employer?
Right. Employer-sponsored health insurance. Yeah, that cost.
Our clients. Our
or if you have an HSA. But so for people who don't have the ability to do those two things, yeah, he wants essentially, incentives. And incentives run throughout all of his programs. And I think in that case, that'd be helpful for those who don't get your employer-sponsored insurance. The last thing of the ACA here is he does want to require price transparency from healthcare providers, which we know is very important.
Right, but I could talk about that, this one little thing for an hour. Okay, a couple things. One, what does that even mean? What is price transparency? Does that mean when you walk into a hospital, it's like McDonald's, you see the prices on the wall somewhere? Is that what it means? Does it mean that people will be able to access that information on a elective surgery so they can see what the bottom line price to them is going to be?
Right.
Not what the charge amount is, but actually what the price is that facility typically accepts. We try to change our plan language.
Right.
So I just feel that in regards to the price transparency type statement, that no one really knows what that actually means. I don't think Trump or anyone in the administration actually knows what that means. It definitely sounds nice to say we want transparency. Obama wanted transparency as well.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't exist. The state of Massachusetts passed a transparency law for all the hospitals in our state. It's not real. You know, they say these things, but it's not like you can go somewhere at Children's Hospital and see, oh, this is what's going to cost to remove my tonsils here. I mean, it just doesn't exist.
But the counter to that was brought up last week was comparing that to purchasing gas. So they're talking about as a consumer, you can go from gas station to decide what gas, what price you want to buy. And, yes, you have full disclosure so you can decide how much gas is going to cost you. But do you care and are you in the business of knowing how much money the gas station is paying to get that gas?
Right. And I think the answer to that is, you know, there are obviously, even our employees, right, we make sure that we're purely transparent in regards to the cost of care. But unless you actually incentivize the employees to care about the cost of care, none of this is going to matter. And I think that's the key. But, you know, tying the providers right back to the selling plans across state lines, the whole beauty of a plan, the reason why someone chooses United plan or a Blue Cross plan or a Cigna plan is the network that particular plan has. So if I'm in California and now I'm able to access a health plan in New Mexico, well, that health plan in New Mexico, aren't there providers in New Mexico, not in California? So isn't the idea of a network of facilities as part of a plan obsolete if you're able to purchase insurance across the lines?
No.
The number one biggest reason why you pick a certain certain health plan is because you like their network, I would think.
But who's not in the network now? I mean, that's already the problem.
Well, a facility in New Mexico wouldn't be in the California network per se. Yet you can purchase insurance from New Mexico.
Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't really make any sense.
I think that the theme here with a lot of these provisions is that it's not quite clear. I think we'll know a lot more, too, when he announces his pick for HHS secretary. That hasn't happened yet, but you can bet there are a lot of people in Congress who hold both law degrees and medical degrees, and one of them will probably get the nod. Once that happens, we can probably look at their background and see what, you know, get some more answers to these questions. Just a quick note on a comment from before. Someone mentioned how can Trump cancel executive orders that Obama had issued that have to do with legislation or spending? He can't. He can only do those with regard to policies like enforcement of immigration laws. That's what I was talking about, just to clear that quick point up. Moving on to Medicaid, his plan for Medicaid is very similar to an old Republican plan, which is to block grant the entire program to the states. So as it stands now, the states had to expand or they would lose their funding. The Medicaid program. Some states chose to, some states didn't. Trump would just send the whole thing to the states, let them figure it out. With regard to prescription drugs, a good idea is being floated. We'll see what he does in the details with this, but to permit consumers to import drugs from other countries where it's a lot cheaper. As everyone knows, the United States has some of the most high-cost drugs anywhere in the world.
We have done over 100 advisory opinions on this issue, and based on our collective, you know, expertise on this, is there's no question it's not legal for a plan to purchase drugs from Canada, let's say. But the way most plans get around it is they have the employee purchase, the consumer, purchase the drug, they have it mail order delivered, and then they get reimbursed by the employer.
Mm-hmm.
They have arguments that that's also not legal, but it's not enforced. Because we know for a fact that we represent at least 100 municipality plans. I want to make sure I get people to understand this. Already, just our little company has over 100 municipality plans where the employees buy the drugs from Canada. These are cities, towns, counties that have been doing it for years. So clearly, even the county plans have their attorneys saying, you can do this, because they're not really enforcing the regulation anyway. So expanding this, I think, obviously, would be the first thing I'm seeing here, really, that focuses on an actual real way to reduce the cost
right.
of the care, which was not done under Romney Care and with our Connected Plan here or with the ACA as a whole.
Right, and just a quick button up to the issue on the prescription drugs, and a comment was just made about this. Trump had said on the campaign trail that he would like to see Medicare be able to negotiate drug prices. There was a last-minute slip in the ACA prevented that, and that's a huge deal. Medicare and
think about that, guys. Peru, the country of Poland, okay, Romania, has the right to negotiate prices with pharmaceuticals. We passed a law that doesn't allow us to negotiate prices with pharmaceutical companies.
Right.
That's insane. We are the largest buyer. Go to any suburb. Trust me. We are the largest buyer of prescription drugs. And we don't – it's illegal for us to negotiate the prices. To me, there is no question that is something – that would reduce the overall cost if we just actually had the ability to negotiate. Amazing.
Right. And we'll see if Trump really intends to drain the swamp, as he says, we'll get some of those lobbyist, you know, preferred provisions stricken from the bill. So the next slide here we have is
This is an important one because this ties in what was talked about earlier. So great slide, Brady.
So this is about Congress's priorities. I'm sure many of you remember that back in June, Speaker Ryan had unveiled his Better Way plan. I mean, it was a vision for America that included a number of legislative priorities. One of the big ones, obviously, is health care. And so I outlined some of the key features of the plan as he's announced them, and you'll see there's some overlap with things Trump has said. So we have refundable tax credits for those without employer coverage. We talked about that. The allow of purchase of insurance across state lines.
We talked about that.
He's going to budget $25 billion to restore the state high risk pools. Again, that's meant to help insurers that have burdensome risk pools, at least initially. So he'll provide some funding for that. Expanding HSAs. Here we see it again. And he wants to permit small businesses and trade groups to form insurance purchasing pools.
So on this one right here, the businesses and trade associations to form purchasing pools. Right now in the self-care industry, we use co-ops and we use captives.
Mm-hmm.
To basically do the exact same thing. We have plenty of clients that are 20, 30 lives or 50 lives. They join a captive
mm-hmm.
where they share that risk up to a certain dollar point. Then there's the captive pool, and then there's reinsurance on the back end. So obviously that has definitely lowered the overall cost because of that pooling power
right.
and the risk aversion piece. So, you know, and we've seen, based on the fact that I'll have this question for you, based on – you know, the MIWAs and the discussion of co-ops, and there's certain limitations. Being able to get rid of some of those limitations where there's a lot more ability to pool insurance options, what do you think that would make a big difference?
Absolutely. It's going to give more opportunity that doesn't exist right now.
Yeah, great. And that's always a good thing. So if you look at the next feature of his plan would be, this has to do with the Cadillac tax, and he wants to limit the tax exclusion for employer-sponsored health plans. Right now, he wants to limit it to $2,500 annually per individual, plus $1,500 annually for dependents. And so this Cadillac tax, we think basically Republicans don't like it. This is a way to replace it with a limit on the tax exclusion for employer-sponsored plans. That'll be a good thing for employer-sponsored plans.
So could someone argue, if they didn't like Speaker Ryan, that he's increasing taxes?
They could. But I think for him, this is a way of trying to compromise because he doesn't like the Cadillac tax. It's not very popular. And he understands that, you know, if you have the Cadillac tax is a huge source of funding, frankly, for other sicker risk pools. And so he's trying to find a compromise and a way to get the best of both worlds.
This next one I think is important to everyone listening because it's an issue that I don't think it's enough media attention on.
Right, and which is protecting self-insurance by essentially preventing the Department of Labor and HHS from reclassifying stop loss as group health insurance, which they've been trying to do, as we know.
Right. This is a big deal. Obviously, if this was able to be something that could be done, it would allow stop loss carriers to not be concerned with being classified as health insurance and then subjecting them to all the mandates and all the rules and so forth. So that's really important. And the last two,
right.
Brady?
Last two are Medicare reform, which Trump has promised he wouldn't touch Medicare. But Congress has said that they would like to make changes. And finally, tort reform, which many of you, I'm sure, have heard much about. Basically, that's about capping non-economic damage awards and limits on contingency fees for us attorneys.
So Jen, let's get into what we think is going to happen. I know everyone wants to hear from you a little bit more even. So let's talk about what you expect to happen in 2017 and then following this slide, what they need to do to prepare for all of next year.
Right. All right, so before we kind of get into this, I like to think about things in a couple of categories. The first is, what's it going to take for something to happen, and what actually is going to happen? So before I get into that, I want to give a real quick story about that someone last week I had read an article about that made a really, I think, relevant comparison of Donald Trump to Clinton, Bill Clinton. And he compared both Trump and Clinton, Bill Clinton, to Obama. And the comparison was talking about how both Bill and Donald, whenever they were faced with a room of 100 people, they would find the two out of the 100 who did not like them and try to find a way to gain likability. That was not necessarily the case for Barack Obama. So the thing to take away from that is it seems like when we're talking about what is likely to happen, there has been inference and implications that Donald Trump does like when people like what he likes. He likes to be liked. So keeping in mind that he likes to be liked, there's a possibility that what the media has to say, what people have to say about the reform and the repeal or the amendment or whatever it is that he wants to do must have to gain a little bit of popularity, and if it does, that would probably make it a little bit more likely to actually appeal. So what it's going to take. So I know that Brady is dying to talk about this a little bit, but let me give a little bit of an overview about what actually could possibly happen and what it might actually take to happen. So in order for there to be legislation to pass, we're going to need the House of Representatives and the Senate in order to approve this legislation, right, Brady?
Right. And so just a quick, I don't want to get too much in the weeds on this, but as many of you I'm sure have heard, you know, there's this thing in the Senate called the filibuster, and Democrats are certainly likely to try to use it to prevent a full repeal of Obamacare. But as many of you probably also know, much of Obamacare was passed through a budget conciliation process that only requires a majority of Congress, 51 votes in the Senate, rather, to pass. And so much of it can be undone the same way. So essentially, when you defund parts of the bill, it effectively kills parts of the bill. So to repeal the whole thing, though, you will need 60 votes in the Senate. Now, again,
that won't happen.
That probably won't happen. I mean, because what would happen, the Democrats would filibuster, and the Republicans could, in theory, try to change the filibuster rules, but that would hurt them when they're on the other side of an election, which was the case, you know, 5-6 years ago. So I think it's unlikely. I think what you'll see, though, is that much of the parts of the bill that were passed through the budget reconciliation process, those parts will be fair game for Trump to tackle.
So it wouldn't actually be a repeal. It would just be a defunding of certain pieces.
Correct. And so maybe more of an amendment.
And they can argue, they can, you know, from a media standpoint, they can call it a repeal if they want to, but at the end of the day, it's not a repeal.
Right. That's
in any sense of the word.
Correct. Okay. It's more of an amending.
So say it did. And what happens in that case? 25 million people are going to lose the current coverage that they would have under an exchange plan.
And that brings us back to the idea of Trump wanting to be liked.
Right.
Got it.
So we know that if there is something that's popular, that it probably is going to stay in place. So there are a couple of things that we know seem to be very likely that are going to happen. The two being expanded coverage for kids through age 26, dependent kids through age 26, and the prohibition against pre-existing condition limitations.
Sure.
So when we're talking about what actually is going to happen, I think it's also important to talk about not what is going to happen, but when this possibly could happen. How early could this happen? And one of the stats that I did think was really relevant was the day after the election on November 9th, which was, we said, 2 weeks ago, that 100,000 people enrolled in a marketplace plan. Why? Because they were nervous it was going to go away, because they realized that maybe this was an important thing to have. And also, the other stat that Brady had reminded me of is that in the month of November, there have been over 1 million people that had enrolled in an exchange plan, which is one of the highest months ever since the exchanges have been around.
Right.
So that means that people are starting to pay attention to benefits. People obviously are interested, whether or not right or wrong or what it is that they're interested in. People seem to want to get them covered right now. So since we know that the enrollment for 1-1 plans, 2017 plans, is already off the ground, premiums and plans have been set, the likelihood of complete repeal and elimination of the exchanges as we know it, or the plans that we know it right now, or repealing these benefits, is probably unlikely, because these plans are going to have to be in place for as long as the purchasers of these plans
have paid for.
So,
or you got to reimburse their money.
Right.
Right.
So the earliest possible change could possibly be what? 2018. So that's not the first 190 days. I know, or the first 100 days. I know I'm not good at math, but a year from now, at the earliest, seems like when the exchange type of plans could potentially.
So let's go over these last four of things that you think could happen. Is, for example, keeping the donut hole filled in for the Medicare Rx coverage, and what else?
Yeah, so as far as the likely things that are going to happen, I don't think that it's a shock that a lot of these taxes are going to go away. The repeal of the Cadillac tax we talked about, the medical device tax, the health insurance tax. So these things to keep in mind, too, when we're talking about these taxes that are being repealed, when you're talking about Affordable Care Act as it is today versus what it could be tomorrow, there are a lot of taxes and things that are in place for fully insured plans that self-funded plans are exempt from. So when we're talking about how this overhaul could potentially change and the things that might be modified, is that what if some of these taxes or some of these things that are in place are going to be repealed would only impact the fully insured plans anyways? So what would the impact be for a self-funded plan if these taxes didn't necessarily apply for them in the first place?
So how do we get ready for next year, Jen? I mean, we're 6 weeks away, right? So what are some of the things we have to look out for?
Pay attention. I think that's the most important thing to pay attention. Who's going to be filling these seats? What are the things that potentially Trump is going to announce that might have an indication of things that might change? But we know right now that we have certain requirements that are in place that have not been repealed. First is for April. Their SBC template is changing. So the way the SBCs are being issued right now, the form that is being used for the SBCs, that has a different look as of April. So that is certainly something that we still need to be aware of. The non-discrimination rules under ACA, the ability to consider sex as one of the protected classes, which we cannot necessarily discriminate against. There has been a lot of litigation surrounding this lately, not necessarily only about transgender issues, but also about pregnancy discrimination issues. There have been lawsuits that have been claiming that if you deny coverage to a dependent daughter, that it is discriminating on the basis of sex, and that's a violation of 1557 under the Affordable Care Act. So there's a lot of litigation still that's going to be surrounded what this is going to mean for plans and the types of benefits that they're going to have to offer, that the out-of-pocket limits are going to increase potentially for non-grandfather plans. They are going to increase as far as what it is that we can allow. There have been some recent FAQs in October, the end of October, about mental health parity and the types of things that you can and cannot do. It's going to be important now with essentially the rising cost of mental health coverage and the increased utilization of mental health services that you need to make sure you're in compliance and you can do whatever it is that you can to offset those costs somehow. Also making sure that you're taking a look at any sort of continuation of coverage provisions that you have within your plan, whether or not it's written in only your handbook or only in your plan document. You need to make sure that both those mirror whatever your stop-loss policy says. The ADA combination for a leave of absence is a newer concept that may not necessarily, which hasn't been in a lot of plan documents in the past. So now is the time to pay attention to that and make sure you eliminate any potential gaps that you might have if you have an employee that is requesting this leave and you're unsure whether or not a continuation of coverage is required to be offered as a result of that leave of absence. The next is making sure that you're aware that everything that you have, as you understand it to be, is in compliance. Because it's very possible that the DOL is going to still be doing audits, regardless of what the administration or who is in place as far as the administration is concerned. It is going to be important to have compliant documents in place.
Well, it's funny you say that because, you know, we hear from people all over the country, right, that, yeah, some of these rules might be in place in regards to compliance, but who's actually going to enforce the compliance if Trump is in office? But the reality is the Department of Labor is separate from, you know, President-elect Trump, where they, as long as the law is in place, they're going to keep following the rules. And we have seen a major uptick in the number of audits that we have seen across the country. But I think it's really important is this plan amendment language, Jen,
right,
that I think is pretty brilliant. But what are we noticing and what are we doing now on behalf of our clients when we're doing their plan docs?
So people are scared. They don't know what's going to happen. Everyone is scared of the uncertainty because they don't necessarily know what it's going to look like for their pockets. So that's why people are concerned. Obviously, they care about providing their employees benefits. It helps attract good and keep good talent. So one of the things that we've been seeing in plans is having a provision added to their plans that says that they are going to be automatically modified or amended to comply with whatever the relevant law is. Is it a good idea? Yes. Is it scary? Yeah, because we don't know what those changes are going to be.
But we have sample language that can be utilized and incorporated into amendments. So if you are planning on amending your plan or restating it, feel free to reach out to us and we can help you with that stuff as well as incorporate this language as well. Now, as it relates to self-funded plans, we talked about a lot, you know, that affects everybody. But from a standpoint of, you know, stop loss, now one of the things that I've known since 2014, I've been following this carefully, is that you literally have now 9 states that have had stop loss regulation on a state level. Because as many of you know, even though a self-funded plan is exempt from, based on ERISA from state law, stop loss is subject to state law. So if you're in California and you have regulation related to stop loss, it will limit or impede your ability to self-fund in the first place. So one of the key questions is, are we going to see more or less regulation from states against stop loss? We talked about Paul Ryan, how they want to make sure the stop loss is not looked upon as health insurance. But I think, Jen, this is Jen, you and Brady, this is an important issue that, you know, you would expect less regulation of stop loss. And I think, Brady, you brought up a great point of the fact that Trump owns companies that are self-funded. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I did some digging on this issue of stop loss, and come to find out, Trump himself owns some companies that have self-insured plans, and they have stop-loss coverage. So I give the example of a Trump payroll corporation, which uses Tokio Marine HCC. So, I mean, we would expect, we think, that Trump would possibly be, you know, gentle, if at all, dealing with stop-loss, because he has a stake in the matter, and probably that colors some of his ideology and his opinions on this type of insurance. And, of course, we noted overall that the Trump administration is expected to reduce regulations. He had in his 10-point plan, he wants to, for every one new regulation, he wants to get rid of two. So we can expect at the federal level not to see any messing with stop loss. At the state level, however, we might still see a continued effort to, you know, mess with attachment points and set other requirements, but that remains to be seen.
I mean, I think if you look at the states, I mean, most of them are from more liberal-leaning states that are regulating the stop loss.
Absolutely.
You have California, New York, you know, Connecticut. I mean, it's definitely more left in regards to that. So that, I think, is an important issue. But the key comes down to, again, how much enforcement there are that there is going to be in regards to the rules that are in place. But we just think it's better to be safe than sorry. Correct, Jen?
Right. There's plenty of examples right now of rules that are in place but not necessarily thoroughly enforced. And that could potentially be the case with self-insurance, too, and stop-loss regulation.
So people, of course, bring up, you know, reference-based pricing comes up no matter what the issue is. So people are talking about how does Trump, a Trump presidency, impact reference-based pricing, especially when they're talking about transparency. Can you share some insight on that, Jen?
I think one of the scariest things that we have going on right now that we'd all agree with is there is a clear lack of transparency. One of the ways that we have found to invite transparency is by having these pricing plans where we're using various methodologies and pricing parameters and making it very clear that we're only going to pay for what the actual cost of the service is. We shouldn't be charging and paying excessively high charges for something that is arbitrary and is not, oftentimes is based on a contract or an agreement that we can't even see in the first place. So the answer to that is potentially to have RBP-type plans or reference-based pricing plans, whatever the terminology that you want to use for it, to see expansion and growth of those types of options. And when we say RBP, it's really important to remember that it's not necessarily a complete elimination of the network itself. There are a lot of variations and types of RBP plans. So if you have questions or issues or want to talk to us about the options that might be available to you, we do encourage you to talk to us, reach out to us, so we can help you set up a plan that is going to invite this transparency that you can work to save and conserve dollars.
So speaking of transparency, there's been a lot of stories about the Sutter Healthcare System in Northern California, the largest, in, you know, that's there. You know, recently, for those of you who know, there was a big whistleblower lawsuit. They paid $46 million to settle over basically double and triple billing of anesthesia claims. Dr. Bert Foreman, a good friend, was the whistleblower in that case. Now he's living the life. Anyways, now Sutter is strong-arming insurance companies either waive the right to sue them for any type of breach or lose your in-network discounts. So, again, we're talking about transparency. Everyone has the right to transparency. You want to know what the costs are, et cetera. They're basically saying we're going to remove any ability to have any transparency based on our network contracts.
Right.
So even though your plan design can say we want full transparency, we have the ability to look at the costs, we have the ability to look at the invoices, the billing, et cetera, you can give away those rights if you agree to a network contract. And what Sutter is telling the employees and insurance companies is, listen, you're not going to be able to do any of these things if you want to have these discounts. So in my opinion, I'm almost like, you know what? Screw it. We won't take the discounts. You're going to have to prove that what you're charging is the right amount of money. It is a reasonable, and I'm not preaching my fiduciary duty to do that. So really quick, guys, in the last couple minutes, just so everyone knows, we have gotten 200-something questions and comments. Some of them are comments we cannot repeat. It is a feed. So, but we will email everyone with all the questions in response. It might take us a couple of days, but we'll make sure Brady gets on that right away. I'm sure he doesn't have enough work to do. But as always, folks, especially now when we have a year of disruption, no one knows what's going to happen, please take a look at our ICE service where you can actually purchase on a PEPM basis access to our litigation, our legal team, our compliance team, for any and all issues relating to anything related to your self-funded plan. Obviously, email any of us for that information, or you can contact Garrett Hunt, who's our sales guy as well. And I want to make sure that you come back on December 13th. So after you've lost all that weight you gained this weekend from eating all that turkey, in a couple of weeks, we're going to do a 2,000 FIA forecast. We're going to incorporate some of this stuff. Brady will be back. Thank God you'll be back, Brady. See that? You did a good job. But we're going to probably know more about who are the top picks for, like, HHS, et cetera, so we can give you an even better forecast as to what to expect, not only from the presidential race, but from Congress, but also just from stuff that we're seeing in the market. This is going to be more of less election, more just nuts and bolts things you got to put in place for your plan. So we hope to see you on December 13th. And it's Brady, everyone's saying good job to you on the tweet. I mean, there are a couple bad ones out there, but on behalf of Jen McCormick, Brady, and myself, we want to say thank you so much for dialing in. And again, all of this will be available on our website immediately following this broadcast. And we hope to see you on December 13th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you very much.